Hello and welcome to episode 166 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode, we're joined by music journalist Adrian Thrills. This fella's story with Paul Weller goes back to 1976, even before that Polydor record deal. We'll talk about his 48 Thrills fanzine, one of the original punk fanzines that started in November 1976, with exclusive on bands like the Sex Pistols, The Clash, Subway Sex, and of course, The Jam. Adrian was there at the 100 Club, Ronnie Scott's, The Marquee, Nashville, and so many more iconic venues with the band, even heading off with them on their early tours. Places like Dunstable, Falkirk, even Barrow-in-Furness, for goodness sake. This fella is such a legend in Weller circles that he's even mentioned on the back of the Dig the New Breed album. We'll talk about his career as an NME journalist in the 80s, and plenty of connections with Weller, from The Jam to The Style Council to Solo to now. He even got to write sleeve notes on albums like The Very Best of The Jam, Live at the BBC, and Hit Parade. You're going to love this one. Let's get into it. Adrian Thrills, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here.
I'm really looking forward to digging into your stories because, I mean, your relationship with Paul Weller, The Jam, goes back to early 1976. I mean, we're talking pre-record deal, right?
Absolutely, very much so, yeah. I mean, I probably first saw The Jam, I would think, probably about September 76, and I'd become aware of them. I was a kind of proto-punk living in kind of the London suburbs and been through like the soul scene. I was a kind of suburban soul boy, and hadn't really, apart from Bowie and Roxy, I hadn't had really that much interest in rock music. And then a couple of friends said, go and see this band called the Sex Pistols. So I went to see the Pistols in about August 76, and I kind of found my tribe, as it were, and immediately I kind of saw the Pistols, the Clash, and got totally immersed in the kind of very early London punk scene, which, despite its kind of, you know, tabloid media reputation as being this kind of horribly violent thing, was actually a really, to me and the people I met, was a really kind of innocent and naive sort of scene. Everyone was so friendly, and, you know, this kind of reputation that the punks had. I certainly didn't see it at those early gigs. I think that was a kind of later manifestation of the post-Grundy thing. I made a few mates there, Shane McGowan being one of them, and I can't remember who it was that first mentioned The Jam, but we kind of heard about this band who were basically kind of dressed in mod gear, but were playing with the kind of energy of punk, and we noticed where they were playing. I think they were supporting a band called Rugulator, a pub rock band at the 100 Club. So I went along with Shane and a couple of others, and we were just blown away by the energy, by Weller's intensity on stage. Their set in those days was a kind of mixture of soulful originals and classic kind of Motown and Stax and old R&B covers, as was the way in those days. I mean, the Jam in those early days, they didn't really have an audience. Unlike the Pistols and the Clash, you had a kind of ready-made punk audience. The Jam, it took them a while. It took them a few months, certainly, really, I would say, until In the City came out. It was only really with the first album that you kind of started getting identifiable Jam fans. I mean, punk and the whole London scene at that time, it was so exciting because it hadn't really coalesced. No one kind of really knew what it was about, the stereotypes. I mean, I think even when I first started going, people weren't even sure if it was called punk or not. You know, it was just kind of new bunch of bands. But I mean, the Jam was slightly apart from, you know, they were like, as Weller famously said, the black sheep of the new wave. And because they had these, kind of, they dressed in sharp suits and they played these old 60s covers, as did the Pistols, actually. The early Pistols, half of their set was old 60s covers. But Weller, I don't think he really saw punk as a year zero. He saw it as a continuation of something that had started in the 60s, with the mod scene. And yeah, there were some great early gigs, really good memories. And there's nothing really, I mean, I've seen Paul play many amazing gigs over the years, but there, as we've seen the Clash early on, there's something about that private party that, you know that you kind of saw something as it was kind of forming.
So how old are you at this point?
I'm a little bit younger than Paul. I was 17, I guess, at that point. I remember I used to go and see the Clash for a period in late 76, more or less every weekend, there'd be a Clash gig somewhere. Likewise, the Jam shortly afterwards, but in quite weird places. I mean, the Jam played the pub rock circuit, so they played the Hope and Anchor and the Marquee, usually as a support act. You know, the Clash I saw in a place in Ilford. I saw them in Leighton Buzzard. I saw the Jam in Dunstable. They weren't playing the kind of the hot spots of the West End all the time. People would play gigs wherever they could get them. There's famously the gig at one of the gigs at the Marquee where they were supporting a band called Bearded Lady.
This is mentioned on Dig the New Breed, right? Yeah.
On Dig the New Breed theme notes, yeah, where Paul was, which was, as was the way you get in those days, a lot of gigs, people, as a kind of hangover from the kind of hippie and the progressive rock thing, people would go to gigs and they'd sit down cross-legged at the floor. And so... So the Bearded Lady fans, they came in and they sat cross-legged on the floor as the Jam were like cranking out these mod punk anthems at 100 miles an hour. And Paul got increasingly frustrated at that and invited Shane, myself, and another early Jam fan, Claudio Magnani, on stage, as he said, I think, to the disgust of the Marquee hippies, to kind of gyrate very... on stage with the Jam.
You're just on stage then, just pogoing about, presumably.
Pogoing and doing a bit of kind of mod dancing and just to try and liven up the crowd, get some sort of reaction. You know, I'm sure it didn't go down too well with the seated masses.
You mentioned like the strange venues, because there's even like, you know, there's even a slot at Ronnie Scott's where they're upstairs at Ronnie Scott's in the kind of bar area, right? That would have been the end of 76.
Yeah, they did. I was at that show as well. That was, late 76, upstairs at Ronnie's. They weren't big enough really to play the kind of hallowed downstairs ground. And it was upstairs. And again, Paul was, he was on fire in those days. And he famously smashed up a guitar. I can't remember if it was a Rickenbacker, but... And we smashed up a guitar on stage, you know, kind of emulating Pete Townsend, I guess. I remember walking out with Shane McGow and Shane Sowell, you know, that was just so inspiring seeing me, you know, that smashing that guitar, you know. I was on stage twice with the Jam, actually. There was once the famous Marquee incident, and there was another very brief appearance when they're playing the Red Cow. I think it was just before they did their residency there. It was encored with Batman. For some reason, they came back on stage and Rick Buckler had disappeared. Like, he'd just gone for a toilet break. And Paul said, "Thrills, can you play drums?" And went, "No." He said, "Well, just like try and hold a beat and and we'll do it." And then luckily, to save my blushes, Rick, just as they were about to start the song, Rick reappeared. So kind of a very sort of a 10-second spot behind the drum kit. But
fair enough. So it's fair to say, I mean, your career did not go in a musical direction in the sense that you could play, you could sing and all that. But
I briefly was in a band with Shane, actually. Shane and Shan Bradley, we sort of messed around a little bit in someone's kind of, you know, makeshift bedroom studio. But it was never really for me. I always figured out I'd have more of a chance of writing about these characters than actually performing as such. But I did a fanzine, 48 Thrills, which was one of the first of the punk fanzines, very much in the vein of Sniffing Glue. And the clue's in the title. It was a fanzine. I mean, you know, it was basically dedicated to the Clash and the Jam. I did one of the first ever Jam interviews, again with Shane McGowan in tow. We interviewed Paul at the Hunter Club.
What can you remember about that first interview? This was like pre like any media for them really at that point, right?
Yeah, even then Paul was very into punk, but he had his own take on it, and he even thought then, you know, some of the punk bands were becoming stars, and he didn't like that. I mean, I think Pete Townsend once said of Paul, he's never a musician as hung up on their credibility as Paul. You know, he was so vehemently against any kind of what he would see as a sellout. He took the punk thing, that DIY, no sellout thing, very, very to heart, very much to heart. I can't remember much about the interview. I know we talked a bit about, he talked a lot about mod and his inspirations and he was inspired by punk and just the thoughts of really lots of young bands getting together. And even though Paul was 18 when the Jam first started really breaking into the London circuit, and he was a couple of years younger, three or four years younger than most of the punk bands. I mean, Paul was 24 when the Jam split up. You know, it's
It's like no age at all, is it really?
No. The idea that, I always still find mind-boggling that George Harrison was 27 when the Beatles split up. You know, but to have done all of the Jam by the age of 24 is quite astonishing, really.
You talked about the fact there was this real snobbery around the Jam.
Yeah, I think it's because they just didn't. There was a certain punk orthodoxy, and punk was a slightly, it was kind of quite art school and fashion conscious. Not that Paul isn't those things, because he very much is those things, but he, I don't know, he just, I think is in the sounds of the street on the first Jam album. You know, I come from Woking, and you'll say I'm a fraud. I think there was a little bit of that, which actually was one of the Jam's great strengths, that they spoke to those kids in suburban towns. At the time I first got into the Jam, I was living in Stevenage, which is a new town about 25 miles from London. You know, Paul was in Woking. We were kind of classic suburban kids. I think Paul, he sort of somehow felt slightly apart from the London punk scene, even though the bands themselves, I think, really liked the Jam. You'd quite often see Joe Strummer was at a lot of Jam gigs. You'd see Glenn Matlock and Steve Jones there. I remember one of the marquee gigs, and it wasn't the Bearded Lady one, it was a bit earlier than that. I remember they were supporting Little Bob Story, a French rock and roll singer. They were supporting Little Bob. And I remember at that gig, I noticed that Malcolm McLaren was standing at the back of the hall with a couple of the Pistols. And I'd met Malcolm, and I'd sort of been to quite a few Pistols gigs. And he kind of beckoned me over, and he kind of said, "Got something for you here." And he kind of reached into his coat and gave me a hot off the press copy of Anarchy in the UK.
Oh my God.
7-inch single, which I've still got in its plastic sleeve. And so there was, they were very much in the scene, but not quite of it. They had a kind of strange relationship with punk. And I think in the long term, that probably suited well, because he never really has been that comfortable at being pigeonholed. And I think you saw that towards the end of the Jam, when they embraced far more kind of soul and R&B influences and started using horns. You know, he kind of never really kind of wanted to be kind of an orthodox punk.
The 48 Thrills, so you create this, one of the original punk fanzines. First issue came out November 1976. Worth an absolute fortune now, folks, if you've got one of those, right? Proper punk ethos, in the sense that, like, fully DIY. This is you at home sticking images onto a piece of A4, folding it up, stapling it, all that, right?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, we used to, and it kind of, I think the print run of the first one was about 25 to 50 maybe, and then it gradually ballooned. So to kind of, I think by the end, we weren't doing any more, maybe 1,000 copies, 1,500 copies. We used to go to, there was a print workshop in Poland Street in the West End. So I'd go in there with my typed and handcrafted sheets. And I couldn't afford it. If you paid a lot, they had different rates. One of them was just to kind of print them, double-sided print, but you had to pay a lot more. They would automatically staple them, but that kind of, my budget didn't stretch to that. So,
right.
And I do remember, actually, with one of the issues, I had all the unstapled sheets, and I knew that the Jam were in Polydor Studios in just off New Bond Street, just off Bond Street, recording their debut album. And I thought, I'd pop in, see how it was going. I think they were doing away from the numbers at the time. And we literally put all the pages of the fanzine out on the floor in the control room, and Paul, Rick and Bruce helped me staple that issue together. In those days, the proximity and the access you had to the bands was just it was incredible. You literally were going on tour with them. They were pals as much as I wasn't writing about them in a detached journalistic way. It was very much, we were all part of the same thing.
You're going to, I mean, some very glamorous places. We're talking about Crawley and Barrow in Furness and all sorts. That access thing's really interesting, because I mean, that's not a huge audience that you had for the fanzine, but the fact that you can get that access, you can join them on the road, you're writing about them, you're part of that inner circle, is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Even you've seen Paul do amazing gigs since then, Albert Hall and the O2, Glastonbury, whatever. But for those who were there in the early days, there is something special about that. They were good times. I mean, the relationship between the journalist and the band, it obviously changes. I went on to write for The Enemy, and even then, I mean, we got incredible access to bands. Would think unbelievable now, but the relationship does change slightly, in that you are slightly more detached, more critical. And I mean, I stayed friends with Paul, but there would be moments where there'd be disagreements over a review. And I think there was a period, of course, where it didn't take too kindly to like the new romantic scene, and he kind of thought that The Enemy had strayed a little bit too much into that kind of London. I remember he sort of chastised me and other Enemy writers from the stage at a gig at Savelle Centre as the Enemy cocktail set, you know.
I heard there was another word in that phrase.
I think there was. Yeah. That ruffled a few feathers. I felt the Jam as well by 81. In respect, looking back, I think I was wrong, but I felt they were in a bit of a rut at that point. And I reviewed a Rainbow show where I kind of said they're in a rut and it's going to take all of Weller's flair to get them out of it. And I think as well, he also probably sensed around that period that the Jam, as a vehicle for his songwriting, he'd probably taken it as far as he could. And you could see it in the later Jam singles. And I mean, the Jam finished with Beat Surrender and the Star Council began with Speak Like a Child. And if you put those records back to back, there's not a world of difference, really. I think there was quite a seamless transition into the more eclectic music he was making with the Star Council. I think it was on the cards anyway. And I did interview him actually after that review and the Enemy cocktail set jibe. I did interview him again just at the very end of the Jam, and I made Beat Surrender, I made Single of the Week, and I interviewed them on the first episode of The Tube, and I kind of interviewed them backstage there. And
yeah, it would have been one of their final, if not the final TV performance of theirs.
Yeah, and I didn't see the final gig. I didn't see the Brighton one. I saw one of the Wembley shows just before, which was an emotional night.
Because it's that thing, I guess there's also that part of you that's been following the journey from the beginning. You're tied into the, you know, that inner circle, like I say, as a journalist. There's also you as a fan, right? And you're a young kid, you love this band. So when Paul calls it quits, did you have that same kind of reaction that so many fans had over the end of the band?
It was clearly a momentous time for Jam fans. No, not really, to be honest, because I think much as I was a Jam fan and I was very involved in most of their career as a fan and as a journalist, I think I also felt it was time for him to move on. I mean, I know Rick and Bruce and many other people would say that the Jam could have, you know, gone, he could have taken it further. I'm sure he could have done, but I think he just wanted to. He's a very restless individual, man, and he's tended to operate a very scorched earth policy towards his past career, where every time he's kind of moved on to a new incarnation. So when he formed the Style Council, he didn't play Jam songs live. I think, you know, once he launched his solo career at first, it was very much focused on just the solo material. I think he's mellowed a lot in, you know, in recent years. He takes a more, I guess, a grown-up attitude, and he kind of sees it as, he's able to see as the great entire body of work that it is.
And it was only really when, I mean, he did early days of the solo years because he had to, played a Style Council, a little bit of Jam, but it was only when that acoustic tour happened that really then suddenly it was embracing and seeing the whole thing as a big catalogue, this incredible catalogue. And we'll talk about the Style Council and solo. There's a couple of other things I want to ask about the Jam. So there's this wonderful picture in, what would it have been, 77, the Nashville, of you, Shane, Claudio, you're all in ties and you're going absolutely mad for it. You know the one I'm talking about?
I do, yeah. I don't know. It's weird because I don't think we didn't have a meeting beforehand to coordinate our dress, but we did all turn up at that show wearing pretty much the same thing. We were just fixtures. We did follow them around, and along with, you know, a couple others. I mean, Jill Price, who later became Paul's girlfriend, was very much part of our little gang. You know, you'd see the same people gig in, gig out, really, and you'd always chat to the band afterwards. And, you know, I went to Paul's house a few times in Woking when, you know, just stopping off on the way back from gigs. And even then, I knew he was a kind of a Beatles fan. I didn't realize his childhood bedroom was a shrine to the Fab Four, with posters, Beatles memorabilia, Beatles fan club magazine, pretty much every edition of that. I mean, he was a real Fabs junkie, you know.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you wonder, I mean, so many of the things that they then did and Paul's done seems to reflect the Beatles and McCartney particularly and stuff, where you go, you know, even like the fan club and that being a thing, that wasn't really like every band weren't doing that, but that mirrored the Beatles stuff, right? Even you wonder if like the length of time they were together tied in with the Jam, with the Beatles and stuff like that, you know?
It's almost
identical time period, right? Issue 3 of 48 Thrills, you reviewed in The City the single, so you got that really early on.
I guess I did, yeah. And In the City, There's a Thousand Things I Want to Say to You, as it was originally called. Yeah, kind of. I got Paul to, I asked him for some lyrics, and he He was always a good letter writer, Paul. He, way before mobile phones or texts or emails or whatever, so occasionally I'd send him a copy of the magazine. He'd write a letter back, almost critiquing that issue. It was kind of, lively up yourself, Adrian. This was a crap issue, And he did. He typed out the lyrics of a couple of songs, one of which was In the City, and it was called In the City, There's a Thousand Things I Want to Say to You. That was always going to be the debut single.
It's a great start, isn't it? It's absolutely brilliant. You mentioned the studio. So I think you talked about the fact that 1980, so you're at NME, and they sweep the board at the Reader's Poll. I mean, literally win every single award. Probably even the female ones as well. And you went and told them about the fact that they'd won this award, and then get to see them recording. This is Townhouse Studios. Get to see them recording Going Underground.
Right, yeah. It was just their moment by that point. They were like the biggest band in Britain, not just in the NME. The singles were going straight in at number one. It was their imperial phase. And they were making such amazing records at that time as well. And I think along with Vic Smith, Vic Coppersmith Heaven, they'd hit a sound that they kind of struck, Ormond Cons onwards. They kind of found a real sound. And they were on a roll between, Ormond Cons and kind of Setting Suns, and even the non-album singles in between, like Strange Town and When You're Young. A bit like The Clash, from the same point, The Clash released two or three non-album singles that I think was, Clash, City Rockers, Complete Control, that, didn't come up on albums. You forget these bands, they were just chucking out this stuff. Nowadays, any one of those tracks would be the lead track on an album. But in those days, they were just stopgap non-album singles.
Which is mad, isn't it? I remember, and you wrote that in the sleeve notes for The Very Best of the Jam. This would have been, 97? And you talked about, while some of the Jam's finest moments remain tucked away on B-sides and obscure album tracks, there could be no doubt that they were a truly great singles band. But again, that echoes the Beatles thing, doesn't it? Where they were doing the singles that weren't on albums, and the singles were such an important thing for them, and the B-sides as well.
Yeah, I mean, they were great. I mean, I just love Strange Town and When You're Young. I just thought both those records when they came out, and even the B-side, Butterfly Collector on Strange Town, that's in anyone else's hands. It's one of your best songs, and it's just a B-side.
And the same is true of the Style Council. Again, such a, hugely successful singles band, cracking B-sides. But the fact that the B-sides were so strong, that the Jam and the Style Council, they were playing them as part of the tour set list. That's how good they are.
Yeah, incredible consistency.
Finishing off on the Jam, one thing that came up as well was there was an interview where you chatted with Paul on the tour bus in Brighton.
And
he was talking about how serious he took it, and he said, we're not like the Boomtown Rats who are just having a laugh. I think it's important for bands to take themselves seriously. This wasn't always fun for him, was it? It was proper serious work.
No, that was that was in Zigzag, that interview, and I think he probably might have had a few beers in the coach coming back from the gig, and he was just shooting from the hip. And I think sometimes he just say things, and you read them. I remember I spoke to him a few weeks after that came out, and he said, either he kind of felt he overstepped the mark, or he just didn't like reading back what he'd said. It wasn't anything I had written. It was just, I've interviewed him so many times over the years, and he'll always, he's a very honest and, he'll speak his mind.
He could be pretty tricky at times, though. I mean, Gary Crowley and I had this conversation. I know you're, friends with Gary Crowley as well. He wasn't always the kindest to you folks, was he, as an interviewee?
Yeah, no, I think there was a lot of tit for tat. And I think that was as much as Paul himself, it was also symptomatic of the times. They were less sensitive times. So people would, I know Twitter is can be quite a brutal place these days, but interviews you did in those days, they weren't bland. And, artists, they didn't like a question, they'd let you know. There was a fair bit of give and take. And, Paul was, he did take it very seriously. He needed to take the Jam very seriously. But then I think as well, after a while, all that kind of seriousness and all that spokesman for a generation stuff, I think it did get on top of him, which is why Style Council, there's a bit more levity in a lot of what the Style Council did, even though they'd still, the Style Council, there was more social realism and politics in some of the songs. But I think as a concept, Style Council was a little bit more frivolous than the Jam.
Yeah, and certainly even like the music videos were, you know, more tongue-in-cheek, lots more silliness involved, and probably realizing that some of this music industry stuff is just utterly ridiculous. So let's just poke it, and see what happens. Did you have much connection with the Style Council? Was that your band? And did you interview Paul during that time?
We still kept in touch, and I'd see them live. I remember going down to the Solid Bond a few times. I didn't have quite the same connection as we did in the Jam era. They made some great music, and you know, you could see his songwriting developed, and you know, the range of influences, you know, some serious, some not so serious, French and Italian shtick, and you know, the kind of Gauloises and cappuccinos and stuff like that. It was all kind of a bit of fun, really, wasn't it? But underneath it, there was still, you know, the songwriting, which is what you always come back to with Paul, is just he is a great, one of the great British songwriters, and the body of work he's produced over getting on for 50 years now is pretty breathtaking.
Yeah, remarkable, isn't it? We get the solo years and Paul's bigger than ever. I mean, Stanley Road, like, you know, his biggest selling album from anything, any period. Yeah. And at that point, Polydor then realize, you know, start re-releasing and repackaging, and we get the very best of the Jam, where you do Sleeve Notes. We get Live at the BBC, where you do Sleeve Notes. So I wanted to dig into some of those, because there was a really interesting bit in the very best of the Jam, actually, where you were talking about the impact of some of the bands you've mentioned, some of the artists you've mentioned that, you know, we know Paul was, you know, was influenced by, you know, Small Faces, the Beatles, Kinks, that type of thing. But you mentioned about the impact of the Gang of Four and Wire, and the impact that they had on Paul's writing, which was often neglected to be mentioned, was how you phrased it. You kind of read little snippets, but it's not something I've ever really dug into properly.
I think Paul he's a musical fanatic, and even now he's still, you can tell in the stuff he's into, he'll love listening to new stuff. And he was really taken with that kind of slightly post-punk, very angular, mostly northern bands, you know, the Gang of Four, the Mekons. It was around the time of Funeral Pyre. That I think that was a single where you could hear a little bit of that jagged, angular guitars. And it was an avenue in a way that I thought they could have gone down that a lot more. And I think in some ways, Paul, he did revisit it years later on albums like Sonic Kicks. I think there was, you know, that kind of, you know, motoric beats and stuff like that. It probably took him 30 years to kind of, for that particular little kind of strand of influences to come to some kind of fruition. I think it's something he touched on. I mean, yeah, listen to the Gang of Four. I mean, you know, the late Andy Gill, the guitarist, if you listen to his guitar, it was so kind of aggressive and jagged and trebly, and you could hear elements of Wilco Johnson in the Gang of Four, as you could in Paul's rhythm guitar playing. So, you know, you could see there was common ground there. But yeah, it is an oft neglected little kind of back portal of the Jam, where they kind of went a bit post-punk.
And you're right, around Sonic Kicks and bits of Wake Up the Nation and stuff like that, where it's like, you know, those influences become more, and whether he's just gone, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want to do. Because I think there was an interview around that time, I think you interviewed Paul around the album 22 Dreams. That was really him taking off the shackles. You know, he's always created the music he wanted to, but at that point he really did kind of go, well, screw it, I'm just going to do what I want to do, right?
That album in particular, I think it was like the liberation of turning 50 and just thinking, I'm going to make the record I want. And, you know, bits of free jazz.
Bit of tango, yeah.
I remember having a conversation with him about tango. I kind of said, oh, I've been, you know, he always says, yeah, what are you listening to? I said, oh, it's funny, if I've sort of listened to some kind of Latin American music, I really kind of like, you know, there's a couple of bands who are kind of fusing electronic music with tango, and you kind of, wow, can you, you know, send me a tape, burn me a CD, you know. He's always been like that. If he kind of hears of something, he's still got a kind of a wonderful curiosity that not many artists of his standing and experience, you know, you could say, you know, Elton John, for one, you know, he's an avid consumer of like loads of music, but it's hard to think of anyone else other than, you know, Weller is very much still in his 60s. He's still very much in, you know, he wants to listen to new music.
Yeah. And it's one of those things. I mean, Elton John now has got his own radio show on Apple Music or Beats or whatever it's called these days. Weller's done the odd one, but you feel like, actually, Weller needs a weekly slot. The amount of bands and artists he's introduced me to, and you're just like, my God, this man's got incredible taste.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he would do that pretty well.
I love the fact he's asking you to burn him a CD. That's wonderful. And around 22 Dreams, actually, there's one thing he said as well, was about the fact that I think his kids were at that point, you know, Leah and Nat were getting into music and stuff. And he talks about the fact that he sees becoming a musician as a great thing to do. It's still a noble profession, is how he phrased it.
Interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think he's seen the music business from every aspect possible, you know, because, you know, don't forget his career, much as he's been a pretty consistent songwriter, commercially, they've been real lows, and they've been moments where he's gone probably out of fashion. And I think, you know, kind of the tail end of the Style Council, where I think he'd, you know, the Jam fans, I think, are kind of a more loyal and more broad-minded bunch than they're often given credit for. But I think towards the end of the Style Council, he had somehow managed to alienate vast swathes of his audience. And I think also there was that little, the Jam had a slightly tricky period, didn't they? They were putting records out with such regularity. They were so prolific, and the demands were essentially, you know, when they started, it was 2 albums a year. So I don't think the modern world is as bad as it's sometimes painted, but it does feel... it feels a slightly hurried record. And then there was the infamous album that was scrapped between Modern World and All More Comes, where Chris Parry just kind of told him these songs aren't good enough. Did some of those songs ultimately, did they ever surface? I think maybe a few of them did.
I think bits of them then were just reworked and became, from what I understand as well.
So I remember him talking about that album, the one that never was. And there's a song called I Want to Paint. And I think one of the songs from that era, one that I really like is Aunties and Uncles, which I think was the B-side of All Around the World or something, which kind of maybe gives an indication of where they were heading with, you know, it was a slightly kind of more pastoral, kind of reflective sound. And then, of course, he came back with All More Cons, which was just crunching anthems.
Mm. But it could be, you know, that if they'd hadn't had that conversation, well, Chris Parry hadn't pushed back on it, you know, they released that album, The Jam's Done, It's Dead, right? Because, you know, yeah. Album 3, yeah. And then we're not having this conversation, are we? More recent years, I know that you've been a really big fan of output from things like, you know, Saturn's Pattern, we've had on Sunset, Fat Pop. Saturn's Pattern, I want to kick off with, because actually this is not an album that's come up very often on the podcast, but it's a really kind of amazing piece of work, because it's primarily him, it's Ben Gordelia, and it's Andy Crofts, and then lots of little guests and stuff. You said a record that wouldn't have sounded out of place in 1960. 67, Summer of Love, was how you described it.
Yeah, 67, I think, it's a key year for him, just in terms of influences. When the Jam were kind of breaking through, he wasn't a great reader. He didn't have, you know, I don't think he was particularly academic at school. But yeah, he was writing these lyrics that are kind of so poetic and flowery and evocative. I remember asking once, I said, where does it come from? Where does this, you know, this turn of phrase? And the only thing he could pinpoint was listening to early Pink Floyd and Traffic and the Beatles and, you know, that kind of wistful English psychedelia. I think that's where he took it obviously sparked something in his imagination that kind of fed through into these lyrics. 22 Dreams, I think, was a water. I think he was making pretty good solo records, obviously Stanley Road. I think the ones immediately before 22 Dreams, Heliocentric, they were kind of good records. They weren't particularly surprising records. You know, they were thinking that's an avenue you'd almost expect Paul to be going down. And I think with 22 Dreams, he kind of basically ripped up the rule book again. And I mean, 22 Dreams, I always think of as part of a trilogy with Wake Up the Nation and Sonic Kicks, where very different records, but it was like, hang on, I'm going to do something. It's almost like, because when you think, you know, that, you know, that in the 70s and early 80s, there was a Jam, the rest of the 80s with the Style Council, the 90s was the Britpop era of the solo career. But his solo career, actually, it's not just he's had the Jam, the Style Council, and solo. I think even his solo career, you can break up into different incarnations. And I think there was definitely a new one started with the 22 Dreams, where it just became so much more esoteric. With Fat Pop, he's brought a lot of it back to just classic pop songs, you know, 3 minute, very catchy 3 minute singles.
Effortless excellence was what you said about that one. And on Sunset, I know that you really, really liked as well. And you said, you know, even a musician as restless as Paul Weller sometimes feels the urge to return to the sounds that first inspired him. It's that thing of almost back to 67. And one thing you said there about the lyrics, I guess his education was the lyrics of the Beatles, the Kinks and stuff like that. Most kids are not going to be doing like understanding and reading the lyrics in that way. You'd have thought they just like the songs and the melodies and the chorus and you can sing along. It's a different thing, isn't it? To kind of really look into the words and what they mean and that understanding.
Yeah, I think, I mean, another thing about Paul as well is when he did start getting into reading, he then just devoured, he started devouring books. I remember even really early on, he gave me a copy of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in paperback, which I've still got. And, you know, he goes, you've got to read this, you know. I think that was around the time they're doing the second album, and it was, you know, it's all about songs like, you know, The Combine and Standards and stuff, you know, which would that kind of slight dystopian feel to it. Yeah, we were just young and discovering stuff, you know. So I think with Paul, obviously developed a massive interest in poetry, didn't he? He started publishing young poets, and, you know, it wasn't, with Paul, it's always been, he's a great songwriter, but it's always been a coalescence of influences, and it's this poems, there's artwork, there's pop art, there's fashion.
I must ask you about Shane McGowan before we go, because Shane was such an important part of this whole story as well. And I think introducing Chris Parry to the Jam and what started that whole kind of journey as well. I mean, such a key player in that entire scene, and obviously a great friend of yours as well, right?
Yeah. And also I think Shane was important because Shane was one of the faces of London punk. He was in that, you know, that picture at the ICA where he's getting his ear allegedly bitten off. It was actually kind of a small flesh wound, really, if the truth be told. But he was at the front of all the early Pistols gigs, and he was a face of London punk, but also a massive Jam fan. And I think that probably, in a way, having Shane on board, I think, didn't do any harm in terms of the Jam's punk credibility. And he was just always there at the gigs. He was a massive Jam fan. And then Paul, in turn, I think, encouraged and supported his music career, didn't he? I think the Pogues got some early gigs with the Jam.
So I mentioned to Gary Crowley that you were going to be on the podcast. Yeah. And at the time of recording, happy birthday, Gary Crowley. It's his birthday today. Because you've had so many connections with Paul, he said, where do you think this drive from Paul comes from, this phenomenal work rate comes from?
It's a fire inside, isn't it? And you can say, you know, it's his, you know, working class, you know, solid working class roots. But I think it's getting back to being a fan as well. I think just that kind of that love of music. I mean, he's obviously fired by creativity, you know, the magic of a song not being there one moment, and then the next minute you've suddenly got the basis, you've got some chords and words. I don't know, you know, if you could bottle that, you could sell it for millions. I think it's one of those mysteries, isn't it? What buyers, artists, and also, you know, in a way to keep going, because, you know, I'm amazed, you know, I mean, I don't see any reason why Paul, if he stays in good health, that he won't be making music well into old age in the way that Dylan and McCartney. I mean, some of these guys, you look at Van Morrison, you know, even McCartney, they're kind of speeding up.
There's more material. I think Van Morrison's had like two albums in the past year, isn't
he? Yeah. You know, I would think there's still a lot more to come. And since the millennium, I don't think he's really had a long break. Even during COVID, he kind of wrote three albums during, you know, that was that chance for him to just return to exploring the studio. And I guess having his own studio as well, I think just perfect platform. Whenever the muse takes him, he's down to the Black Barn.
But still able to take himself out of the comfort zone. So he ends up doing, you know, the gig with the orchestra for other aspects and true meanings at the time, you know.
Which was a really nice, amazing in a way. He hadn't done it before, but it worked. It was amazing how well those songs worked.
Yeah. And a song like Private Hell with an orchestra in that way, with an acoustic guitar, just sounds remarkable. Back to that kind of power of the songwriting, When was the last time you connected and interviewed Paul? Can you remember?
I bumped into him a few times at I gave some stuff to the exhibition, and there was the Sky Arts documentary.
About the Young Idea, yeah.
It was around the time of those. I kind of get the odd text. He went through a phase. He used to send albums out, certainly as recently as 22 Dreams and Wake Up the Nation. You know, the albums would always come with a handwritten note, you know, hope you like this one.
So nice. I need to get on that mailing list. That's a goal. And then for you as a music journalist, so when did you finish at NME?
I basically worked at the NME through the 80s. I kind of graduated from, I did 48 Thrills and did some stuff for Zigzag, and then got a job on the NME probably about 79. So, you know, I chronicled the Jam quite extensively for the NME. I stayed at the NME to the end of the 80s and worked on record labels for a while after that. In fact, I worked at Go Discs as well when Go Discs put out the second solo album. Yeah, you know, and I still write. I do a music column in the Daily Mail every Friday, which is where all the recent Weller albums are being reviewed. I did sports journalism for a little while in the 90s. It was quite nice to kind of in a way to get away from music writing and then come back. I had a kind of bit of a break from it and then came back.
NME was such a powerful publication at that time, and it's almost kind of criminal now. It's just a website, for goodness sake. But it was, there's such a huge deal to so many people. It was their weekly Bible, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was there, there was a period in the early 80s. I mean, the circulation was 300,000 a week. And even that, they say each copy was read by maybe two or three people. She probably took about a million readers a week at a time when there was the other music papers, obviously, but there wasn't much else There wasn't any music in the national papers. There was no internet, you know, Spotify. Even to, you know, to get a record, you had to physically go out and buy. There was a lot more effort and emotion involved in just accessing the news and accessing the music. And yeah, it was huge. And it was a great time to be part of something that was so much a part of the kind of UK music scene. And, you know, obviously had a lot of clout.
And even from, if you think about where you are now, the Mail polarizes opinion. But if you think it's the biggest website, I think, in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, the Friday Arts section has, you know, we have a lot of, you know, still very extensive music coverage. It's just great being able to reach a kind of an audience, you know, still having a platform to write about stuff.
So many of your contemporaries have written books and their stories and told their tales. There must be a book in you, Adrian, isn't there?
Maybe at some point, possibly. But, you know, it's great chatting to you and kind of recounting some of the stories. But, yeah, in a way, rather wear all that a little bit more lightly. You know, I don't really want to make it about me as such in that way, but we'll see.
I should mention this, so the sleeve of the back sleeve of Dig New Breed, as we wrap things up here. That must have been amazing to get that little mention. So let me read it to you. It says, Paul, and this is Paul's bit. So Paul had a bit, Bruce had a bit, Rick had a bit on the back of the sleeve, right? So this is after the band have split, the end is done. They got final album to deliver, and it's a live album. And Paul says, a brief 6 years. I mean, that's remarkable in itself, right? A brief 6 years, sweaty, frantic Red Cow residency. First week, 50 people. Second week, 100. By the fourth week, a queue round the block. Switch. The marquee with Shane, Claudio and Adrian dancing on the stage to the confusion of the usual marquee hippies. Yeah. A little shout out for you must have been really special. A little surprise.
It was really nice as well, because that came in the wake of the whole cocktail set wars. So it was obvious, you know, there were no hard feelings on Paul's side, which was nice, really.
Nice. Final two questions. You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or solo. Like you say, we're talking about nearly 50 years of material now, right? What are you going to go with?
Well, quite a bit about this one, actually. And I mean, I was torn between going from like a really early song and then something from a later career. And I think a song I really like of 22 Dreams, which is Where You Go, which is a kind of, I remember speaking to Paul at the time about that, and he kind of said he wanted to write something like Danny Boy, like one of those old kind of songs. And it's clearly a song that's written from the perspective of a 50-year-old man, either talking to his kids or his friends or whatever, or kind of, you know, young people going off and fleeing the nest and then coming back. So it's just a lovely and emotional song. But at the same time, I think I would have to go for like one of the earlier anthems, and I would probably go for When You're Young, which is just the obvious classic. You can say Town Called Malice and that's entertainment. But When You're Young, I thought his lyrics by that point, he was coming on. It was in the wake of All Mod Cons. He was obviously incredibly confident as a songwriter. He was confident in the sound of that production, that wall of sound that Vic Smith had come up, you know, helped them create. And those lyrics, you know, the world's your oyster and the future's a clam. Think you're a king, but you're really a pawn. And it's, you know, it's actually quite a depressing song when you listen to the lyrics, but it's also fired with this romantic idealism. I mean, I think, you know, Paul, he's proved himself over the years. He's a really good social commentator and chronicler. He can write political and realistic lyrics, but he's great at that. But I think he's even better writing about just, you know, in a way, kind of the more romantic things and kind of a more romantic view of life. And, I think that song, it just encapsulated, and it, like a lot of these songs, it kind of ebbs and flows. There's different sections and it comes back with like a rousing crescendo at the end. It's, you know, he mastered the art of crafting brilliant 3-minute pop songs by that point.
And standalone singles, that wasn't an album track, right? So that this power of that 7-inch, which must have just been played over and over and over again. And just that here we are still talking about that over 40 years later. I can't believe that that's the thing through like Spotify and streaming in the same way as it was back then. It can't be, surely.
I think, I mean, Spotify is great and, you know, it's brilliant. You can dip into songs, but it's different, isn't it? Because you're listening, if you go into Spotify and type The Jam, they'll curate your listening for you. And it just inevitably, the algorithms will dictate it's Town Called Malice, that's entertainment, Going Underground. You know, it's the big hitters. You know, there's been a bit of a debate about this recently about live gigs. You know, do you go to live gigs just to hear the big hits, or do you go to hear, you know, the back pages? And in some ways, it's the the songs are very rarely played, but hearing a song, that and you've probably never heard live before played is actually kind of more special.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And also, I think as you're talking there, it's also the power of an album. And 22 Dreams is an album that sonically, you have to take that journey from track one to track, the end or whatever it is, track 12, 13, whatever. That takes you on that journey. Whereas if you're just dipping into that one single song on 22 Dreams, which is how the algorithms would work you, it's not the same experience. It's a really interesting thing. Right, final question. So the purpose of this podcast, Adrian, is to meet lovely people like yourself who've had these wonderful connections with Paul and the Jam and the Star Council and Solo and all that. But the reason I started the podcast was for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. It was my one big regret from giving up my life as a radio presenter was that I never got to interview Paul Weller. So if it happens, oh my God, it's got to happen. It's got sometime, surely. Come on, Paul. I should write him a letter. I must do this. Anyway, if it happens, Adrian, what should I ask him?
I would just ask him a general question about his lyrical inspiration. And I think something I've asked him, and he'll speak about kind of the Kinks and Traffic and stuff like that. But where does he think it comes from? And he probably won't be able to give you an answer because it's just, it probably varies song to song, and it's a kind of unfathomable thing, just sort of capturing the uncapturable, really,
And it's weird, isn't it? Because, I know there have been times where he's talked about having writer's block and whatever, but it just seems effortless. The amount of material coming out, it seems so easy.
Yeah, and I'm sure it isn't easy either. I'm sure there's times when it just comes to him, and other times that he probably has to work at it. Maybe if it's not coming, you just leave it, It's, he's probably fortunate now at this stage in his career. He can work to his own deadlines. So it's not like the early days of the Jam where Polydor, they wanted the second album 6 months after the first. Ideally, I think the third album, if it had been up to scratch, would have come out 6 months after This Is the Modern World, after Modern World. So
it's not like you having to hit a Friday deadline or the NME where you're hitting your weekly deadline, is it? It's not like this hard finish. It's up to him. He's in control.
Yeah.
Adrian, this has been so lovely chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's been lovely digging into these memories.
Cheers, then. Take care. Look forward to hearing it.
Well, there you go. Once again, my thanks to Adrian Thrills for joining me on the podcast. What a journey from 1976 to now, from In the City to Fat Pop Volume 1, and much more in between. A real joy. Don't forget, you can head to my website for the show notes for this episode of the podcast. You'll find them, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Whilst you're there, dig into our huge audio archive packed full of interviews, conversations, blogs and photographs from so many Weller connections. We're talking fans, friends, family, band members, past, present, and who knows, maybe some of them future, thinking about it. Incredible talent that's collaborated with Paul, supported him on tour, and so many, many stories. Do head on the website. You'll find all the details, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. We've got some really, really special episodes coming up for you, okay? I don't usually tease things too much, but here's two real big highlights for you, okay? Huge Jam fan, Style Council, Paul Weller. We're going to be talking to the legend that is Keiko on the podcast, okay? If you've seen the About the Young Idea documentary, you'll know exactly who I mean. A massive fan. This is really special. Coming next on the podcast, plus, in a couple of weeks' time, the absolute legend of a talent that is Carlene Anderson on the podcast. Make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, and more, and spread the word. Tell your friends. Social media, we're at WellerFanPod on Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week. Or you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.